It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
You have to see who the whistleblower is.
A direct call from the President of the United States for the public outing of the whistleblower's identity.
You know who it is. You just don't want to report it.
A sentiment echoed by Kentucky Senator Rand Paul just last night at a Trump rally in Kentucky.
I say tonight to the media, do your job and print his name.
But in an age of text messages, Twitter, and 24-hour communication, news outlets have yet to publish the name.
The whistleblower statute was never meant to give you anonymity. It was meant to allow you to come forward without being fired.
Not entirely true, according to Stephen Cohn, an attorney representing whistleblowers for 35 years. He wrote a book called The Whistleblower's Handbook and represented Linda Tripp when her name was outed during the Clinton Lewinsky scandal.
For any politician, elected official to urge publicly that the law be violated, it's most troubling and irresponsible.
A law passed in 2014 offers multiple protections for whistleblowers, including anonymity and no retaliation. One person who must follow that law, the President of the United States.
The laws, it couldn't be clearer. Quote, the President shall provide for the enforcement of this section, period. The President must protect this whistleblower. The President must tell Rand Paul to stand down.
If a member of Congress leaks the name, the member could be censured or forced to give up committee assignments. Members of Congress receive dozens of complaints each year, but the sensitive nature of the complaints stops them from becoming public. This case is different. Cohn tells Fox News a small group of people are supposed to know the whistleblower's identity. Top brass at the Intelligence Community Inspector General's office know the name, and the chair and ranking members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees likely do as well. Officials here at the Department of Justice tell Fox News no one inside this building behind me, including the Attorney General, know the identity of the whistleblower. Brett.
All right. That is not a new report. That was September of 2019. That was September. That's what started this entire impeachment process against the president. Sandy Rios with you. And I just kind of want to give some background today. I think I'm going to start with that because we're in full throated impeachment mode as the House managers present their case before the Senate. And I want to be real clear about how this started. We have so much news coming at us that it's easy to forget. The whistleblower filed this complaint with the inspector general. The difference in this whistleblower was that he had no direct knowledge. He's talking about a phone call that President Trump made with the president of Ukraine, Zelensky. And he said in his complaint that someone told him what the president had said. He claims that the president was trying to threaten the president of Ukraine that he would withhold aid if he did not look into Joe Biden and his son Hunter, and that meant that the president was trying to interfere with the upcoming presidential election because Joe Biden would likely be his opponent. And so, therefore, the president was once again trying to interfere with elections, and he had to be stopped. And how frightening it was. It was a very, very dramatic complaint that the whistleblower made. Now, the whistleblower, again, had no firsthand knowledge, and so the inspector general decided that he would sort of change the rules a bit and allow a secondhand account by this whistleblower to be brought into the to the House of Representatives. And that's what they did. It would be like in a court of law. They never allow hearsay evidence. You have to have firsthand knowledge. You have to be a witness. You have to know something personally. So But that an exception was made by the inspector general, which we'll get to him in just a second. So we're told that this whistleblower is a former CIA analyst. He's a Ukraine expert. He works in the White House. He worked in the White House. And so, of course, he knew the president. He knew. He had inside knowledge. But he didn't hear that phone call. And the phone call was characterized in various ways. Of course, Adam Schiff in the House impeachment hearings completely distorted the transcript. The president released it. He said, okay, there was nothing wrong with that phone call. Here's the transcript. We read it. I read it. I put it on our Facebook page. Many of you read it. You saw it in the newspaper. Nothing like that was said. There was no mention of withholding aid. There was no threat. He basically said, I want to talk to you about that CrowdStrike. And then at the end, he says something about, could you look into this corrupt energy company, Burisma, in your country and find out what's going on with Hunter Biden and that company? Because Hunter Biden was making millions of dollars sitting on the board with absolutely no expertise and was appointed after his dad, of course, was vice president of the United States. And, of course, Joe Biden was on record himself bragging with various expletives about how he threatened the former Ukrainian president that if he did not fire the prosecutor that was looking into Burisma, the company his son was sitting on the board, if the president of Ukraine at that time did not fire the prosecutor, he would withhold the aid. But conveniently, the Washington Post, ABC, CNN, the rest of them, that's not quid pro quo. That's different than what the president said in the phone call directly with the new president, Zelensky, although it isn't different. It is different. And the fact that the president didn't do that, Joe Biden did that. Joe Biden blatantly, it's there, look it up on YouTube. He threatened the Ukrainian president at that time that he would oversee the withholding of millions of American dollars and funds if that president did not fire the current prosecutor. And he did fire him, Joe Biden said with glee and with an expletive. So that's kind of the background. But I've told you now since not long after this broke, who the whistleblower was. His name is Eric Chiramella. Just this week, an investigation came out by Paul Sperry for Real Clear Investigations. And I want to focus on that in the remaining moments I have with you today. I want to talk to you about who Eric Chiramella is in more detail and who the people around him were, because this is fascinating. And by the way, I can't get to all of it. We'll put this article on our Facebook page so that you can read and share it. This is how Paul begins. Barely 2 weeks after Donald Trump took office, Eric Chiramella, the CIA analyst whose name was recently linked in a tweet by the president and mentioned by lawmakers as the anonymous whistleblower who touched off Trump's impeachment, was overheard in the White House discussing with another staffer how to remove the newly elected president from office, according to former colleagues. And that's just the beginning. Sources told Real Clear Investigations the staffer with whom Chiramella was speaking was Sean Misko. Both were Obama administration holdovers working in the Trump White House. And this is the part that I keep harping on, that many, many, many of us were very concerned about the people sitting around that table as national security advisors, first under Michael Flynn and then under the general that followed him, who was fired by President Trump. Eventually, finally, after he had undermined him, the president, in any way that he could. But back to Sean Misko. Sean and Eric Chiramella are sitting on the NSC. Just days after he was sworn in, they were already talking about getting rid of him, said a White House colleague who overheard their conversation. They weren't just bent on subverting his agenda, they were plotting to actually have him removed from office. So now, what happened with that? These are two young guys. They can say anything. They can chat. They can not like the president. As a matter of fact, it talks about how in the first meeting that they had, I think it was 2 weeks after the president was in office, General Flynn was leading because he was head of NSC, and they were sitting there whispering back and forth and undermining and groaning and saying, we have to get rid of this president. We can't enact these policies. And I think people thought, according to Paul's article, all right, people can say anything, but, you know, that doesn't mean they can do anything. But this is what they did. Misko, Sean Misko, left the White House just last summer. Think about it. He's been there all this time. Sean Misko left the White House last summer to join House impeachment manager, who do you think? Adam Schiff. Sean Misko left the White House last summer to join Adam Schiff's impeachment committee, where sources say he offered guidance to the whistleblower, who has been officially identified only as an intelligence officer in a complaint against Trump. In other words, officially, Eric Chiaramella hasn't been named, but we all know it's Eric Chiaramella. Misko then helped run the impeachment inquiry based on that complaint as a top investigator for congressional Democrats. And basically what happened was let me just lay the case a little bit better here. So Sean Misko is then on Adam Schiff's committee, and his buddy, Eric Chiaramella, just then happens to get this tip from Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. Now, who was Lieutenant Colonel Vindman? We talked about this during the, he was kind of the hero of the, for the left, in the impeachment hearings in the House. But we know a lot more about him now. He was actually very good friends with these guys. They'd worked together. And Lieutenant Colonel Vindman has been described as, he was actually reprimanded when he was in the field working as an active duty military person. He was reprimanded because they were working with Russians, and he was repeatedly criticizing and mocking America and Americans to them, and was heard doing that. So the whistleblower, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, we believe, is the one who then told Eric Chiaramella, his friend, that he heard that conversation with the president in Ukraine, and he characterized it in a way that, when we actually saw the transcript, was just not at all what the president said. So Eric Chiaramella, based on that tip from seemingly anti-American Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who the left painted as such a war hero, remember he testified in his uniform, using that tip, Eric Chiaramella goes and files the whistleblower complaint. But, of course, the whistleblower is a person who should have first-hand knowledge, is not hearing a report from someone that they know. And then, of course, the machine went into overdrive to protect this poor whistleblower. The president was threatening him. You better not mention his name, senators, congressmen, because if you do, you'll be punished. There's a whistleblower law. You heard that report at the top of the hour. So the media went into hyperventilation about this whistleblower and his bravery and how we should make sure that we don't put his life in danger. So he's been hiding ever since, probably having a great time, probably getting paid while he does nothing. So he is an expert on Ukraine, and he hates the president. That's what these reports from inside the White House, former co-workers, more than one of them is a military person who heard them. They did not like the president's policies. So Paul goes on to write, Democrats based their impeachment case on the whistleblower complaint, which alleges that President Trump sought to help his reelection campaign by demanding that Ukraine's leader investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter in exchange for military aid. Yet Schiff, who heads the House Intelligence Committee, and other Democrats have insisted on keeping the identity of the whistleblower secret, citing concern for his safety, while arguing that his testimony no longer matters because other witnesses and documents have corroborated what he alleged in his complaint about the Ukraine call. He is still in hiding. You're going to be hearing when they start talking about witnesses. I hope that some Republican senator asked to talk to this whistleblower. It would be really interesting, don't you think, to hear what he has to say and let him answer some questions from Ted Cruz, from Josh Hawley, from Rand Paul, and you fill in the blank, Mike Lee. I'd love to see that, wouldn't you? Don't hold your breath. This article and this investigation, I just touched the very bare top of it. There are other people involved in this that Paul has uncovered, but we'll put the investigation piece on our Facebook page. It's Paul Sperry of Real Clear Investigations, and it will help you as you watch this blah blah the next days and hours unfold, and it'll help you to kind of keep some perspective. All right, coming up next, did they really drop the investigation into the Clintons? We'll find out. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Another Justice Department investigation related to Hillary Clinton is reportedly ending without any tangible results. President Trump and his allies pushed for the inquiry into possible corruption concerning the Clinton Foundation and the sale of a company called Uranium One when Clinton was Secretary of State. But sources tell the Washington Post investigators have effectively wrapped up the case and found nothing worth pursuing.
That was an ABC report 10 days ago, maybe something like that. And it came on the heels of a headline out of the Washington Post: Justice Department winds down Clinton-related inquiry once championed by Trump. It found nothing of consequence. That is the headline for the Washington Post article. And so while we were all, you know, absorbed with impeachment talk, many things have been happening, many important things. This is not even one of the least of this is very important. I've asked Chris Farrell to join me this morning because Judicial Watch has been tracking Hillary Clinton. Probably at least 20 years. I've been interviewing people from Judicial Watch for at least 20 years on Hillary Clinton when Bill was president. Chris is now the director of investigations and research for Judicial Watch, and Chris is a former counterintelligence case officer. He does much of the research and oversees so much of the work that Judicial Watch does, and I don't need to tell you how effective they have been. Chris, welcome to the show. And first question, could it possibly be true that the Justice Department is winding down investigations into Mrs. Clinton and Bill Clinton and the Clinton Foundation?
Well, it's great to be with you, first of all. And secondly, as part of your intro, you talked about, you know, 20 years talking about this. I've been at Judicial Watch for 20 years, right along with you, doing what we do. And, this Huber investigation, which was, you know, the kind of the audio bite coming into the segment. Look, if you're not looking for anything, don't be surprised when you don't find anything, right? So at the same time, Huber is claiming that there's nothing there. In the last 10 days, we received yet another new batch of 5,000 Hillary Clinton emails, several of which were marked as being classified. So I don't know how you missed this. We're receiving records and documents by court order in our litigation concerning the Hillary Clinton email server, which has its roots, believe it or not, in Benghazi.
Yeah.
And by court order, the federal government is producing records to us that they are saying are classified. Yet somehow, simultaneously, Mr. Huber says, "Look, nothing there, nothing, no misconduct, no breaking of laws." So I don't know how the Department of Justice squares that.
You know what? Let's talk about John. Honestly, Chris, as closely as I think I follow these things, I did not know John Huber's background. I knew he was from Utah, and I remember being, you know, really encouraged when Jeff Sessions, Attorney General Sessions, appointed him to investigate this Clinton mess, this part of the corruption scandal in the United States. But I did not realize that John Huber actually was an Obama appointee originally. What else do we know about him?
Well, I mean, that's sadly the case. You know, if you look at the Justice Department right now, you have Attorney General Barr and probably a dozen people around him, his inner circle, that he trusts. And the rest of headquarters Department of Justice is manned and staffed with essentially a clone army of Sally Yates's and Bruce Orr's.
That's probably too kind.
The building.
That might be too kind, Chris. That might be too kind. The comparison, the reason I say that is because, you know, our mutual friend Christian Adams did a whole expose a few years ago on the appointments that Obama was making. And, man, it's like a list of the radical of the radicals, the appointees appointees.
And the day-to-day business, the regular routine operations at Headquarters Department of Justice, the best way to analyze the staff there is to look at their Federal Election Commission reporting on donations, and they overwhelmingly donate to left liberal candidates like Hillary Clinton. And then, you know, when the government decides to go home to go to sleep at night, where does it go? Well, it goes to places like Montgomery County, Maryland, and Arlington and Fairfax. And so if you look at the voting demographics of the counties surrounding Washington, D.C., they're all, you know, 80% plus voting in favor of Hillary Clinton. And so there's the rank and file the folks manning the cubicles and the cube farms, you know, on the third floor back in the corner, they're all Obamaites and Clintonistas. And that's who's in, you know, and so the Attorney General is the Attorney General. He's sitting on top of this Leviathan. But his staff is either sort of passively non-committal neutral all the way over to actively, subversively working against him. That's the operating environment. And so no one should be surprised that, you know, the wheels churn on and the great, you know, monstrosity of the swamp continues to do what it does, because that's the folks who man all the agencies and departments of the federal government.
I want to read just a couple of lines from this Post article, because the news outlet known as Washington Post, in their news story, say current and former officials said that Huber, the prosecutor from Utah assigned to investigate Hillary, has largely finished and found nothing worth pursuing. Now, Chris, I'm thinking that you read that with are you so cynical that that's funny, or did that make you mad?
I don't know if I consider it funny. It's the standard fare, you know. You get a McDonald's and you get a hamburger, and it's just that's what they do. Hubris is the same guy that neither him nor his staff bothered to accept information or even attend a hearing back in December 2018. Where investigators detailed how they had given thousands of pages of evidence and whistleblower testimony to Huber, and they scrupulously ignored it. And then Congress held a hearing on it. Congressman Mark Meadows presided over the hearing. The video clip of it's up on YouTube. Anybody can watch it. And these folks went through and discussed the Clinton Foundation, the way the money was laundered around, all sorts of details, documents, testimony. And again, if you're not looking for it, don't be surprised when you don't find it.
All right. So you believe that this report from the Washington Post, at least in regard to John Huber, is accurate. But I'm getting ahead of myself because I want to talk about that a little bit more. I want to talk about Uranium One in a second here. But there's another prosecutor or investigator who is the Connecticut U.S. attorney, who's also John, but it's John Durham. Do you have any faith that John Durham is actually looking into this, whether Huber did it or not, that Durham is actually expanding his investigation to include the Clintons?
I'm encouraged by Mr. Durham, and I'll tell you why. He has an established track record of going after internal government corruption with respect to Whitey Bulger in Boston. Folks will recall that Bulger was a mobster in Boston who had a bizarre relationship with the FBI in that city, where the FBI essentially licensed him to go out and kill people. So the FBI was completely out of control in handling Bulger and handling organized crime in Boston. The corruption was, beyond belief. This wasn't just the sort of a guy taking an envelope. This was the FBI agent sanctioning this guy killing other people. And so Durham went into that and dismantled the entire thing and cleaned house. And so, to his credit, he's not afraid of bumping up against the institutional powers of the Department of Justice and the FBI and, you know, asking unpleasant questions and pushing and shoving to get the answers. So I find that very heartening, because that's exactly what he has to do in this case with a cast of characters like, you know, Comey and McCabe and Strzok and all the rest of them. So that I find encouraging. It's not a guarantee. There's a lot of institutional pushback. The FBI and the Department of Justice can be very vindictive and sinister when it comes to their efforts to protect themselves. There's a lot of institutional resistance and pressure. But if there's anybody who can do it, I think Durham is highly qualified.
Chris, I was going to ask you this really broad question about Mrs. Clinton's potential crimes. And then I had to laugh at myself because, there's such a long list. And I think if you ask the average citizen, they might be able to, they might say email or server, but they might not fully understand. I think it would be very helpful if we kind of burrow in on why Judicial Watch has been so persistent and why people like me and the president, for heaven's sake, have been so persistent. And let's start with this, the one that you just mentioned, and that is the whole Uranium One scandal. First of all, in just a matter of my own curiosity, I remember, I know you do, that whistleblower who was ill and wanted to talk about what he knew about this Uranium One scandal and the Clintons' involvement. And he had like a, as I understand, like a complete truckload of evidence that the Clintons were up to their ears in eventually letting the Soviet-controlled company have 20% of our uranium, control of that. That's the bottom line of that. But what happened to that witness? Do you know? And what happened to his testimony?
I do not know. I know of what you speak, and I confirm, ratify your explanation or your understanding of it. But I do not know the particulars of what happened to him, nor do I recall who represented him. I'm trying to think of what he had representation from some.
I think it might have been Glory Tensing. It might have been her, Victoria. I mean Tensing. Let's go to the crime because I think of all the things that Hillary Clinton was implicated in. Well, it's a hard choice because we got to talk about Benghazi too. This scandal was most egregious in terms of our national security. Can you explain what we think her part in this was?
It's really a bribery scheme involving Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. And back in 2010, so it's a long time ago, literally a decade ago, Uranium One was sold. And so the question is, how was it done? And what was involved, in a large part, that's the real Russia scandal. You want to scream about Russia.
Right, exactly.
So this guy named Frank Giustra, who is a Canadian, he donates $31 million to the Clinton Foundation and then pledges even more money. He's kind of like the front guy. So he has a company, a Canadian firm. Bill Clinton meets with some people, he goes and makes a speech that he's paid an extraordinarily huge amount of money for. I think it was like half, I can't recall the exact number. It was hundreds of millions of dollars. I think it was $500,000 is my recollection. And then surprise, surprise, there's an arrangement made that supposedly has the oversight of the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., something called CFIUS, which is a watchdog group, a cabinet-level watchdog group that decides or monitors where foreign money in the U.S. is going. Hillary Clinton has a say or has a role in that. And then magically, the sale of these uranium assets occurs. Giustra's sort of the cutout. Bill Clinton is the facilitator with $500,000 for a speaking fee, and out goes Uranium One to in the sale via Giustra. And so, it's a racket, right? This is all sort of payments that appear to be, oh, sure, we're going to pay you $500,000 for one speech. And yeah, we'll bring in a Canadian front entity to make a purchase of something so it doesn't look like it's going to the Russians. And, well, somebody has to approve it. So who's involved in approving it? Oh, Hillary Clinton is via her participation in this Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And so, it's classic Clinton. This goes back to, Johnny Chung and John Wong around the White House. It's the same M.O.
And at that time during because people are young, Chris, they don't remember what we remember. They were selling America's technology to China to enrich themselves in their campaign. That was during the campaign, during his presidency.
Absolutely.
But let me go back because I want to make this really clear. Uranium is a necessary element to put together nuclear weapons. You have to have it. It's a natural substance, and it doesn't grow on trees. It's hard to find. And that is the significance of Mrs. Clinton signing off on giving 20% of our uranium supplies, giving the rights to that to the Russians. Talk about national security, Chris, to enrich the Clinton Foundation.
You know who's done a very good treatment of the entire subject is our mutual friend, Peter Schweitzer. He did a book back, I think it's like 2015, 2016, called Clinton Cash. And he describes this entire arrangement. So if your listeners are curious about that, I'm sure Peter appreciates me selling his book for him. But it really is it's an excellent summary. And yeah. He lays out the entire transaction in very clear ways.
Well, and that's
The problem is, we're discussing it 10 years after the fact. But, I mean, that's really... He captures it very well.
Yeah, but it's same but different, and it is a pattern with him. I mean, I could talk about, if we had the time, about my interview with the Secretary of State of Haiti after that horrible storm down there and how the Clintons virtually, financially raped that island and its people and enriched their staffers by, you know, selling them the cell phone companies. It was just horrendous. While the Clinton Foundation is pretending to help, they're taking in all of this money and they're giving these contracts to their buddies. It's just it's shocking, and it was fascinating to hear that story. And the guy actually cried about how the people of Haiti had been left in poverty and need. All right, so we're talking about the Clintons. According to the Washington Post, the investigation has been dropped. We'll see. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless. And while not the focus of our investigation, we also developed evidence that the security culture of the State Department, in general and with respect to the use of unclassified systems in particular, was generally lacking in the kind of care for classified information that's found elsewhere in the U.S. government. We do assess that hostile actors gained access to the private commercial email accounts of people with whom Secretary Clinton was in regular contact from her personal account. She also used her personal email extensively while outside the United States, including sending and receiving work-related emails in the territory of sophisticated adversaries. We did not find direct evidence that Secretary Clinton's personal email domain, in its various configurations since 2009, was hacked successfully. But given the nature of the system and of the actors potentially involved, we assess we would be unlikely to see such direct evidence. From the group of 30,000 emails returned to the State Department in 2014, 110 emails in 52 email chains have been determined by the owning agency to contain classified information at the time they were sent or received. 8 of those chains contained information that was top secret at the time they were sent. 36 of those chains contained secret information at the time. And 8 contained confidential information at the time. I should add here that we found no evidence that any of the additional work-related emails were intentionally deleted in an effort to conceal them in some way. Our assessment is that, like many email users, Secretary Clinton periodically deleted emails, or emails were purged from her system when devices were changed. Although there is evidence of potential violations of the statutes regarding the handling of classified information, our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case.
That was the director of the FBI, James Comey, in July of 2016, right before the election. And I remember that moment because at that time, part of me still trusted James Comey. I didn't like a lot of the things that he had done, but he was so convincing. He's such an imposing figure, and he'd reached such lofty heights in his career. He wouldn't lie, would he? But now we know more about James Comey. My guest is Chris Farrell, Director of Investigations and Research for Judicial Watch. And by the way, Chris has a great article that we'll post on our Facebook page entitled Justice Department's Non-Investigation of the Clinton Foundation Warrants a Special Counsel. Chris, that must have... you guys have done such yeoman's work on investigating this issue. I just hit the highlights. What was off base about Comey's statement, and what do we now know?
Well, first of all, he's a liar. Let me just be very clear. I'll call it what it is. There is no requirement, there's no element of the crime with respect to the mishandling of national defense information. There's no requirement for proving intent. And he spent a lot of time talking about that. I'm not guessing at this. I did it for a living. I was a special agent of Army counterintelligence. I was involved in multiple counterespionage investigations that successfully resulted in people either being jailed, doubled back against their service, or simply shut down from conducting further espionage against the United States. So 18 U.S.C. Section 793F, for the legal geeks out there, there is no requirement to prove intent. It's not an element of the crime. So he's lying. He goes on at length to manufacture an entirely new legal threshold for pursuing the case. And I can assure you the people who have done a tiny fraction of what Mrs. Clinton has done are sitting in federal penitentiaries. I know it to be true. I can tell you firsthand. So Comey is an extraordinary liar, and he's very good, and he seems like he's in charge. And like you said, he has a good sort of command presence when he makes these pronouncements. But what he said was factually not true. So, the shift or the jig was, it was already arranged that, they had their foregone conclusions months before he ever issued his report. They were writing her exoneration in May, 2 months before they even interviewed her. Even her interview was preposterous. It wasn't under oath. She wasn't going to write sworn statement.
It was like 2 hours on it's like a 2-hour interview on a Saturday.
Saturday morning. Yep. It was a coffee and donut session. It was not a real interview.
Chris, just to make this usable or understandable, I think the reason the American people weren't up in arms about that particular part of the corruption was because we all use email, and certainly the way he presented it there, email is trouble and everybody gets scared. He kind of indicated everybody's
scared. She ordered people to destroy devices. She ordered people to strip off classified marking headings on documents and fax them to her.
Yep.
She ordered people to enter the seventh floor SCIF, the Sensitive Compartment Information Facility, the vault within a vault on the seventh floor of the State Department, and use things like iPads to excerpt highly classified documents off of something called a JWICS, which is the top secret terminal for receiving messages. But she did these outrageous abuses of things that anybody else would be jailed for, and she got a pass.
I think one of the things that helps people to understand, Chris, is when Louis Gohmert was interrogating Peter Strzok, when Peter came to testify before Congress, and Louis, at the end of that testimony, said that we have evidence that, I don't think Louis said China, but I think we found out later that a foreign power has accessed all of Mrs. Clinton's email, and now we know that it's China. I think that helps people understand why this was so bad. That means she was Secretary of State. Everything that she wrote and said and did, all of her communications with the president, all the other whatever dignitaries she talked to, was open to one of our greatest enemies, really, China. And so,
it's called Carter Heavy Industries at gmail.com. That's the email address that was associated with what Mr. Gohmert was talking about. Louis Gohmert's a great man. My understanding from his presentation, talking to some people, is that essentially every single email that Hillary Clinton sent was basically BCC'd, this blind carbon copy to the Chinese. And so, they were eating our lunch while she was, shooting notes off to everybody. The Chinese were reading everything in real time.
Chris, and concurrent with that, her email ended up on the laptop of Anthony Weiner because of her aide, Huma Abedin. So that was a whole dust-up, which we don't have time for that sidebar. I just know that New York City police and detectives and, I believe, federal agents in New York were up in arms about the Justice Department letting her off because of what they knew and what they were seeing.
The FBI tried to suppress that. FBI headquarters tried to suppress that information. And it was, thank God for New York City detectives who pushed back, And I guess the alternative was to leak it to the New York Post, and they said they thought otherwise.
Yeah, but it was they managed to squelch it. As it stands, I know they're still releasing very slowly email to you guys, but that 33,000... she bleach bitted, they destroyed the devices, and they were, we we were told they were impossible to recover. Have you guys recovered any of those?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. In fact, I mentioned earlier that, you know, after this claim that, whoops, they're all gone, they subsequently came up with 5,000 additional emails. And just in the last, like, 2 weeks, we received another 37 pages of material, many of which were marked classified. It also shows that she was texting classified information, not just emailing, but she was also shooting texts back and forth. You know, this is so blatantly, outrageously obvious, but there's just a willing blindness where they don't want to see what's been documented.
Chris, one of the things
folks can read this stuff on our website, judicialwatch.org. This is not a mystery. The documents are available.
I think people are overwhelmed, but I think that's a great idea. And Judicial Watch has just been really the backbone of the country, really the organization that's kind of congealed so many of these scandals and stood steadfast in the face of all kinds of opposition. It's been amazing to watch, Chris. And you know, I'm personally grateful to all of you guys. Let's talk about Benghazi briefly. Our ambassador was killed. Contractors who were former military special agents were murdered that night because they got no help. Our president disappeared, and Mrs. Clinton, too. As far as I know, we hardly knew anything other than a few email, like at 10:30 at night. What do we know now, Chris, after you've had access to some of those email?
Well, we're never going to let it go. It's still under litigation. That is something that we're just going to drill down on until we finally get all the answers. Benghazi is critical because, you know, strangely enough, Benghazi, our investigation there, not just revealed what was really going on and the bravery of our folks at the CIA base in Benghazi, who ended up coming to the aid of the folks trapped on the consular compound. But it revealed the fact that Mrs. Clinton was running this private server illegally. It showed that what really was involved was a desperate attempt by the Obama administration not to have a headline 2 weeks or 6 weeks before the election. And the headline would have been Obama administration arms Al-Qaeda, right? There's a gun running operation coming out of Benghazi that the Obama administration supported, organized, et cetera, that was being run from there. And the last thing they wanted was a headline like that. So they did everything they possibly could to suppress what was actually going on in Benghazi with respect to a $40 million program run out of the State Department to gather up weapons, both man pads, which are shoulder-fired missiles, and other heavier weapons like heavy borders, some of which were boxed up and then shipped over via freighter to Turkey's southernmost port, where it was transshipped over to Syrian forces. And frankly, the Syrian forces that they were shipped to, the Obama administration had no idea who was giving the weapons to. And so that had to be, a lid had to be put on that. It had to be suppressed and contained. And that is the sort of ugly little backstory as to how we got into Benghazi.
Chris, as an aside, why in the world doesn't Barack Obama's email ever show up in her email? And why don't we know, in particular on that night, where was he? Where was he?
Because they're still lying. They are still lying.
All right, so you guys are still trying to get the rest of those email, and Judicial Watch is...
We've taken the deposition of all of Mrs. Clinton's aides, right? Huma Abedin, Cheryl Mills, the whole cast of characters, and we're waiting on Judge Royce Lambert to give us authority to depose Mrs. Clinton, and I hope that comes very soon.
Talk to me about the current Justice Department under, our new Attorney General, whose name escapes me in this minute.
Right.
How is that different, or is it? Are you still running into all these obstacles?
Oh, they fight us tooth and nail. I mean, it's completely incoherent. We have the Trump administration, the General Barr, and like I mentioned before, the rank and file staff attorneys and all the various bureaus, departments, divisions, they are still carrying forward as though it's Obama's still president. They resist and fight and play little semantic word games and obstruct like you would not believe.
Oh, I would. And so, Christopher Wray, it always comes when you and I talk, it always comes back to Chris Wray, who's the current FBI director. I just want to know if your assessment of him remains the same—that he is part of the swamp.
Yeah, he needs to go. I mean, look, he's all about institutional preservation and damage control. That's all that he's about. The FBI, you know, there are some agents who are great. I'll probably put it at like the, you know, 75 to 80% mark of good guys and good gals trying to do the right thing. There's a lot of dirtballs. There's a lot of corrupt agents. It's not nearly, or, you know, Sean Hannity gets on and talks about 99% of the FBI is great. That's just garbage. It's a lie. I know this from my own investigations for the last 20 years of Judicial Watch, for another 15 years, you know, doing counterintelligence stuff for the Army. There are some very fine people doing great stuff, but there's a segment of dirtballs that just exists and always has.
Chris, we have 30.
Ray's part of that.
We have 30 seconds left. If President Trump is impeached, what can we expect on these investigations?
Well, I mean, he has been impeached, but he's not going to be convicted in the Senate. I mean, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah, yes, misspoken. But okay,
so if he gets you know, when he's reelected, he'll be further emboldened.
Yeah. Well, hopefully he'll get better people around him, people that he can trust, and he'll start listening to those of us around him who are trying to get him to hire different people to surround him and advise him. I think the dangers have really come up. The dangers of having people inside his White House who hate him have really come back to bite him. So we're all watching as this unfolds. Chris, thank you so much for all your work at Judicial Watch and to Tom Fitton and the rest. Thank you so much, and thanks for your time today. Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.